The History of Literature podcast is a member of the Podglomerate Network and LitHub Radio. Hello, I'm Jack Wilson. Welcome to the History of Literature. Okay, here we go. This feels like a new beginning. Episode 101. The first episode in a new 100. Holy smokes. There we go. We're off. And we have a good episode today. Maya Angelou talking to Oprah and a visit from our old friend, Mike Palindrome, the president himself, who's going to join me to talk about writers at work. So I'm back from vacation. Thank you for all the emails and tweets and other comments that have piled up while I was gone. Some great suggestions have come in and some heartfelt sentiments, and I appreciate them all. And I also appreciate those of you who have said you'd like to support the show. Well, I have some good news on that front. I've set up a Patreon account. You can head on over to patreon.com/literature and sign up for a donation of as little as $1 a month. And I'm going to put a ceiling on there, too. We'll have a maximum $1 million a month. Beyond that, I will not take your money. Sorry, Mr. Buffett. You're going to have to find some other podcaster to reward. Share the wealth, sir. But seriously, I'm very appreciative for whatever you can give. The way it works is that you sign up for a monthly donation, and I will use that money to defray my costs. I thought about doing it per episode, but I thought monthly might make more sense since the minimum is lower that way for those of you who prefer that option. $12 a year. Of course, you can cancel if you're unhappy, or you can give more if you're happy. This is, well, we'll see how this goes. Fingers are crossed that at least one of you will sign up. That's patreon.com/literature. Let me know how it goes if you choose to do this, and if there's anything you think should run more smoothly or be improved. And if you don't like the idea of recurring payments, stay tuned. We're working on a one-time donation option. That's a little trickier, but we're working on it. Hello, everyone. This is Jack here to tell you about a way to eat better and easier. That's right, Factor. And they're delicious, ready-to-eat meals. These things are amazing. Chef-crafted, always fresh, never frozen. All you do is heat them up and you're ready to go. No prepping, cooking, or cleanup. And you get something healthy, nutritious, and tasty. I love Factor meals, especially on those days when I'm in the office. They're better for me than snacks or junk food, and much cheaper and faster than buying my lunch at a restaurant. You can choose options like Calorie Smart, Protein Plus, Keto, and you can change your schedule to get as much or as little as you need every week, whatever suits you and your family best. Head to factormeals.com/literature50 and use code literature50 to get 50% off. That's code literature50 at factormeals.com/literature50 to get 50% off. Hey, grown-ups, the Cat in the Hat cast is a new podcast from Wondery, perfect for the whole family. Join the Cat in the Hat and your favorite Dr. Seuss characters as they get whisked away on a new adventure every week. Fish dreams of creating his very own polite and quiet podcast. That is, until he gets a surprise visit to his Fishbowl podcast studio from the Cat in the Hat himself, and it becomes very clear that the cat has other plans for the podcast, and those plans are the opposite of quiet. The cat may be disruptive, but it turns out he's also a great help to get Fish out of all kinds of predicaments. Bursting with music, silliness, and rhymes, the Cat in the Hat cast encourages us all to find fun that is funny in every episode. Sing along to new favorite songs, try your luck at Titanic tongue twisters, have some fun with wondrous wordplay, and most importantly, bring your family along for all of the adventures in the Cat in the Hat cast. Follow the Cat in the Hat cast on the Wondery app or wherever you get your podcasts. You can listen to the Cat in the Hat cast ad-free right now by joining Wondery Plus in the Wondery app or Wondery Kids Plus in Apple Podcasts.
Okay, writers at work. What kind of jobs have authors had? What's this? Who's this? Frank! Let it get me down. Frank, what are you doing here? 'Cause this fine old world, it keeps spinning around. That's right, around. Keeps spinning around. I've been a puppet, a pauper, a pirate, a poet, a pawn and a king. Oh, boy. I've been up and down and over a and puppet, out. A pauper, a pirate, a poet, a pawn and a king. How about a potato chip inspector? Or one of Robert Frost's jobs, replacing burned-out filaments in light bulbs. That didn't make it into the song. What jobs help writers work? Which ones don't? Which ones get in the way? And which ones inspire them to greatness? By showing them what they can do, by giving them some great topic to write about, or by making them hate the experience of working so much that they dedicate themselves to their art with renewed energy, if not panic. I've been a puppet, a pauper, a pirate, a poet, a pawn and a king. I've been up. So good. We'll have all that coming up in a second. All that talk about writers. But first, here's a great description of a job by a great American poet, Maya Angelou, who told the story of her experience as the first black streetcar conductor hired by the city of San Francisco. Here she is, telling the story to Oprah. Many times I thought of cutting out, but my heart won't buy it. But if there's nothing shaking come this here July,
I'm gonna roll. You have such a long list of achievements as we were compiling them. You were the first black streetcar conductor in the city of San Francisco.
I was 16.
You were 16?
Yes, I was black, 16, and had the nerve to walk. I saw women on the streetcars with their little changer belts with, you know, that, and they had caps with bills on them, and they had form-fitting jackets.
You liked the uniform.
I loved the uniform. So I said, that's the job I want.
They'd never hired a black person?
They had never, no.
So did you see that as the accomplishment that it was at the time?
No, my mother did. Mm-hmm. Because mother, I said, I went down to place an application and they wouldn't even give it to me. And so I went back to my mother and I said, They wouldn't even allow me to apply. She asked me, why? Do you know why? I said, yes, because I'm a Negro. She said, yes, but do you want the job? I said, yes. She said, go get it. Here, I give you money. Every day you go down, be there before the secretaries get there. You sit there in the office. You read one of your big, thick Russian books. I was reading Dostoevsky or Tolstoy or something at the time. She said, and then when they go to lunch, then you go. Go to a good restaurant. You know how to order good food. Go back before the secretaries get there. I did all of it, and then sit there until they leave. They laughed at me. They pushed out their lips and used some negative racial things. But I sat there.
At 16?
Yes, but look at here. Here's the thing. I sat there because I was afraid to go home. I was afraid to tell my mother that I wasn't as strong as she thought I was.
Wow.
So I sat there for 2 weeks, every day. And then after 2 weeks, a man came out of his office. He said, come in. And he asked me, why do you want the job? I said, I like the uniforms. And I said, and I like people. And so I got the job. Amazing.
What's amazing is the story that you tell in Mom and Me of your mother, knowing that you were a 16-year-old on the streetcars and that she followed you in her.
That's
you
right.
Tell the story.
About 4 o'clock in the morning, she'd wake me up with my bath already drawn. I'd take a bath, put on my uniform, and she would drive me out to the beach. And she had her pistol on the seat of the car. And she would follow the streetcar all the way from the beach down to the ferry building, right through San Francisco, and back again out to the beach until daybreak. I mean, stay close so that nobody got on that she didn't see. And then wow. at 6:30 or 7.
That's a mother.
She's a mother.
That's a mother.
She was really all of that. And she asked me once, she said, now, what did you learn from that job? Because when it was time for me to go back to school, I went back to school. I said, I learned that I like to work. She said, what else did you learn? I said, I don't know. She said, about yourself. You learn that you're very strong. The determination.
Wow.
Dedication. And you can go anywhere in the world. It keeps spinning around. I've been a puppet, a pauper, a pirate, a poet, a pawn and a king. I've been up and down and over and out. And I know one thing. Each time I find myself flat on my face, I pick myself up and get back in the race. That's life.
Okay, so we've got Mike back here. Thanks, Mike, for joining us again on the History of Literature podcast.
Hey, Jack.
So you are headed on vacation soon. I'm wondering, have you got some good books picked out?
Yeah, I do. I'm going to Germany, Holland, and France. So I'm going to bring Hermann Hesse's Damien.
Ooh, okay.
Which
haven't read before?
No, I've only read The Glass Bead Game by him because I'm kind of not interested at all in his Eastern thought novels.
No Siddhartha.
Yeah, because I kind of am not really a believer in Eastern thought, I guess.
So,
but anyway, I read an article about how everyone in South Korea has read Damien.
Oh, interesting.
And it's this book about conformity. Emil is the main character, and he just butts heads against his parents and schools and jobs, and eventually encounters the devil, who gives him some advice, and I don't want to give away the ending, but basically it's a novel it's sort of a Bible against conformity.
That's so interesting.
I can understand why it resonated so much with South Koreans.
Yeah. So. Okay, anything else?
And I'm also going to bring Rilke. I'm going to reread some Rilke. And then I'm bringing Ursula Le Guin's The Left Hand of Darkness.
Ah, okay, that's one I haven't read.
Yeah, which I picked up years ago, but it's a sci-fi novel about a planet where you can choose your gender.
Okay, well, that sounds like a good suitcase, good additions to your suitcase there.
Yeah, and hopefully pick up some books along the way, too, of course.
Yeah, right. Right. I always wonder what to do with them when they start to get heavy. I used to mail them home. You know, I couldn't bear to just throw them out or something. I don't know. Now maybe I would give them away, or maybe I don't travel long enough for that to really become too much of an issue.
Yeah, I'm only gone for 2 weeks, so I'll lug them all.
Yeah, and a lot of people solve that with a Kindle, but I still like pulling out the actual hard copy.
Yeah, nobody will approach you if you're holding a Kindle.
Right. Okay, so today we're going to be talking about writers at work, the different jobs that writers have had. This is a real rabbit hole to go down once you start looking into this. It's there are as many jobs as there are writers, I think.
Yeah, it was pretty fun. You know, obviously they're kind of legends of certain jobs that people held, like Wallace Stevens was an insurance clerk. But then I was delighted to discover all these other jobs, like Kurt Vonnegut sold Saabs.
Yeah. One of the first Saab dealers in North America. That was a great one. And how did you feel? I found it, I started thinking about writers and their jobs and just what it means for a writer to have a job. And I really found that I wanted writers to have had actual jobs. But I know that on the other hand, it's hard to write when you have a job that takes up a lot of time. And so I was kind of torn because on the one hand, I felt like every time I found a writer who was independently wealthy or who inherited money or who had a spouse that worked or something, I kind of looked down on them a little bit for that. But I also recognized that's what every writer would do if they could, is have, you know, all the time they could devote to their writing.
But I found that there's this balance between, I think it's very hard to write if you have no job and no reason to have a job. I think the only person that I came across was maybe Proust. Because, I mean, the way I looked at this was kind of distinct periods of people's lives and the writer's ability to make a break.
Yep.
Like Chiang Rai-Li had gone to Yale undergrad, graduated, you know, top of his class and gotten a job as an investment banker. And he did it for a year and then decided that this is just not the way he wanted to live his life. And he quit and he started writing fiction. And he wrote enough to get into Reed College's MFA program. And there he wrote about 12 to 15 hours a day working on what he considered to be a better novel than Gravity's Rainbow.
Ooh.
Yeah.
So set his sights high.
Yeah. And so I feel like he was able to do that because he had been an investment banker for a year and probably hated it.
Right. And it was all pent up. And he also had a kind of workmanlike work ethic where he knew what it meant to sit yourself down in the chair and stick to it, put in a hard day's work.
Yeah. So, it was funny because some people were like, well, I think the best job is an office job because you can actually write while you're in an office. I'm not sure it is if your hours are long and also if you're surrounded by people who are a certain type.
Yeah.
You're almost better off being a librarian. I feel like a librarian isn't a bad job to be a writer.
Yeah, there's some real... I've turned this into categories, as usual, whenever I try to tackle this. I'm sort of learning that about myself as I prepare for these drafts, is I need to find categories in order to make sense of things. And I put that in my category called old standbys, which was teaching, journalism, publishing, bookstores, and libraries, jobs like that where it's kind of a natural fit for someone who likes books, and those jobs kind of have a bit of room to be around books or to be reading or to maybe be writing. It fits into your schedule a bit better. And definitely there were a few librarians on my list, and I just took teaching out of it altogether. I didn't choose anyone who was a teacher. I almost don't consider that a job, which is terrible. I know it is a job, and I guess I wouldn't say that about teaching kindergarten or teaching in a prison or tutoring or something. But teaching in an MFA program, to me, it's too common, and it just wasn't something that I was really gravitating toward when I was trying to find good examples of writers who have held jobs.
Yeah, I mean, Colm Tobin says that when he teaches a semester of creative writing as a guest teacher, guest lecturer, he can't write at all.
Yeah, I know other professors who have said that as well. That they just don't write. But on the other hand, it just doesn't seem... One of the things that I liked about jobs is when it really gave people something interesting to write about. I think the experience at the MFA program, although there have been some good books that were set there, and I don't mean to disparage the entire experience as not giving people enough to write about, but in general, it seems like it doesn't give that kind of detail or the fresh and the unusual as a subject for people to write about. So why don't we start with our draft? I'll let you pick first, and we'll walk through some of these, but I think there are so many, even though we may have ended up choosing some of the same people, but I think we should also just throw out a lot of jobs that we've run across of different writers as we go and not really limit ourselves to the usual 10 here.
Yeah. I was kind of torn between Anthony Trollope and William Faulkner. Because Trollope worked at the post office.
Yeah.
Which...
Okay, no, take Trollope, and then I'll follow up with Faulkner, because that was my number one. So.
Oh, okay. Because
tell us about Trollope.
I guess what I did was I kind of projected onto some of these, to many of these writers, what I would prefer. And I think that working in a post office, you get enough interaction with people.
Mm-hmm.
But I think your mind, maybe I romanticize it, but you have a kind of a clear head working at the post office because the tasks are so simple.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I have two different post offices in mind, really. There's the kind of the small town where I grew up where basically, you know, they work in there by themselves. You're almost like your own boss. And you maybe have one person who walks in every 15 or 20 minutes. You're pretty much alone. That's different from the post offices that I saw in Chicago or New York, where you maybe are just dealing with long lines of angry customers, and it's almost like working at cash register or something where it's never ending. That seems like it would be more grueling and take more out of you.
Yeah, I mean, I definitely felt that certain jobs were, it's kind of a miracle that people wrote.
Yeah, right. right. So what did Trollope, what was his post office experience?
I think the hours weren't very long because he was able to write in the morning. And that was the other thing that I found myself drawn to is jobs where you could write in the morning rather than at night. Cause so, you know, the problem with day jobs is that, you know, and generally people say, writers say that it's easier to write your best. It's easier to write in the morning because you have a clear head. And a number of people did. Many people write at night, but, you know, Trollope's job allowed him to write 3 hours every morning before he went to work.
Right. So. I think Scott Turow has a setup like that at his law firm where he writes in the morning and then he sees clients and works on cases in the afternoon. It must be because he's bringing in business just because of the fame of his books.
Right.
You know, so it's, he can probably just name his schedule basically, but it's interesting. He wouldn't have to work at all. I mean, he could just write, but I think, something about having, you know, new clients walking in the door is probably very good for his imagination.
Yeah. I mean, I've known people, I've had friends who have stopped writing because they said they were too lonely. You know, preparing for this, thinking about certain jobs, but also just thinking about what it takes to write and how all those thousands of hours you spend by yourself. It just seems like if you could have a job where there was a little levity or perhaps one colleague you liked, it could recharge your batteries, which I always find an annoying phrase, but as I get older, I think it's sort of true.
Your batteries are more in need of recharging. I think you hear that with people who they get the chance to work from home and then they turn it down, or they don't want to work from home every day. They want to go to the office. They want to have that bit of society and that interpersonal interaction. And for a writer, especially if they're given to doubt or laboring over a text and feeling overwhelmed by the experience, you could see where I think a lot of writers long to be in a more collaborative art form too, like to work on a movie or to work on a play or something where you have the input of other creative people and you're part of a community putting something together.
Yeah, I mean, and if you're not one of those writers that wants society, I admired those writers who had figured that out early, like Cheever used to put on a suit and take his elevator, take the elevator downstairs to the basement where he had an arrangement with the super where he could write in the basement. They had a desk and a chair for him.
Right.
And then he'd go back home, take off his suit and, you know, have cocktails. And
yeah.
Yeah. So he clearly wanted nothing to do with people
an
while he was writing.
Office. Right. Right.
Yeah.
Okay. So let me talk about Faulkner. And because one of the reasons why I chose him, he also had a job supervising a power plant, which has got to be one of the most dangerous ideas. It's like probably short of Homer Simpson, it's probably the most dangerous person you could put in charge of a power plant. He was famous for his letter of resignation, which I loved. And that's why I've had him as number one. He was the post office or the postmaster general, I guess, of the University of Mississippi. And his performance left a lot to be desired. There was a lot of accounts of him losing mail and occasionally throwing mail away, which is like a pretty bad thing for your postal worker to do. He ignored colleagues and customers when they came in. He played bridge even when the post office was open. And he showed up late. He left early. And he held it for about 3 years until finally they came and they gave an inspection. And they basically said, this is like the worst post office we've ever inspected. And so he was forced to resign. And he wrote this sort of famous resignation letter. And I'll read it. It's about three sentences here. It's, as long as I live under the capitalistic system, I expect to have my life influenced by the demands of moneyed people. But I will be damned if I propose to be at the beck and call of every itinerant scoundrel who has 2 cents to invest in a postage stamp. This, sir, is my resignation, William Faulkner. Which is great. And he, of course, also had a pretty good career as a Hollywood screenwriter, but a lot of his life was just how do I get enough money to keep writing these novels that need to come pouring out of me? So who's your next pick?
The next one, I went with Agatha Christie.
Oh, yeah. She was on my list, too. She was, I don't mean to jump in here, but she was in my category of people who had the perfect job that set them up for their writing career, you know, that gave them a good topic to write about.
Yeah, you wonder if she had the macabre in her already and would have written those kind of stories, but certainly being a pharmacist assistant exposed her, introduced her to all these great pharmaceutical details.
Mm-hmm.
It was one of these examples where you just need a little bit of expertise, I think, in fiction. Yep.
And she knew all about poisons. And probably, I don't know, 30 or 40 of her books probably draw upon those.
Yeah. I mean, and it, to create that kind of texture in her fiction, because her fiction is so fast paced. But I remember when I read her as a teenager and felt that when she introduced a little twist,
mm-hmm.
it just popped off the page.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Other professions that are really, that's a really good profession that sets her up for that. Other professions like that are spies, I found.
Oh, you know, yeah.
The best spy writers were in intelligence, or it's easy for them to know how things work and what's plausible and what's not plausible. And they probably, you know, spent however many years just hearing all these different stories and meeting all these different people, and John le Carré and Ian Fleming and Graham Greene. And they all did their stint as an intelligence agent. And you know who else did? Roald Dahl.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. And Julia Child.
Oh, yeah. I read about that. Yeah. That's she and her husband were both in it, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. I wonder if in that category of specialist, whether Lewis Carroll being a mathematician had anything to do with Alice in Wonderland and the the trippiness of it.
I'm sure it did. And and Primo Levi is another good example, a chemist, professional chemist.
Yeah.
Who knows? Conrad is another good example of that, a sea captain. He actually was a pretty successful sea captain. And obviously that gave him a lot of specialized detailed knowledge. Or Mark Twain on the riverboat. There's a lot of good examples of that, of expertise making its way into fiction.
Yeah.
Okay. So my second pick, I am going to kind of keep with the theme of writers who wrote while they were at work, but I'm going to move away from those who carved out time or found kind of low-level jobs that allowed them to work to write while they were working, and go to one who was just so good at his job that he was able to write when he was at work, and that's Elmore Leonard.
What was his job?
So he was an advertising guy, and he worked at Chrysler. He's a Detroit guy. He worked at Chrysler in the General Motors building, and the legend that I had heard, which I wasn't able to confirm for the podcast, but I've heard this legend and I'm going to relate it because it's such a good story. The legend is that he used to sit at his desk and he would just type out his novels. He started out, we know him mainly as the crime writer, I think, with Rum Punch, which became Jackie Brown, and Get Shorty. And he had that run of all of those, you know, those great novels, crime novels that turned into movies kind of in the 90s.
Right.
He originally was wrote Westerns and kind of these dime store Westerns. And then he turned that into more of a crime fiction, kind of turned his hand to crime fiction. But while he was working in this advertising department of Chrysler, the legend is that he was sitting at his desk and he was typing away one of his novels, and his supervisor, his manager, was showing around a vice president, and the vice president commented on it and said, "Well, what's that guy working on?" And they said, "Oh, that's Elmore. He's not actually working on a campaign. He's writing his novels." And and they said, you know, the vice president said, "Well, why are we paying him if he's writing a novel?" And they said, "Well, you know, we just kind of leave him alone and let him do it." And the vice president was getting angrier. So the manager walked over and he said, "Hey, Elmore, we're working on an ad campaign and we just can't come up with a good slogan. We need a new slogan to base this campaign around. Do you have anything for us?" And Elmore Leonard looked up and he said, "The heartbeat of America." And then he went back to typing, and the manager went back to the vice president and said, "That's why we leave him alone, and that's why we pay him." So it's a great advertising is a good, it's pretty well represented by some interesting people. Salman Rushdie worked in advertising for a while, F. Scott Fitzgerald and Joseph Heller and Dorothy L. Sayers. And it makes a lot of sense. Part of me always worries that if a writer stays in advertising too long, they might get a bit corrupted, you know, and turn their powers to slogans and catchphrases and just the sort of falsity of advertising.
Well, that, you know, it made me wonder, as you were saying that about the falsity, whether a book critic has that same issue trying to write a novel. Whether, you know, like Volcano Lover by Sontag, or The Book of God by James Wood, you know, whether you have in the back of your mind the criticism language that sort of prevents you from, you know, taking a fictional voice rather than this kind of overall intellectual voice.
Yeah. So. Yeah, I think that's kind of a dangerous profession for an aspiring novelist to take on, is to write, you know, criticism for money. I think they probably worry they make a lot of enemies in the industry, but also, as you said, it's more of the big danger is that they internalize criticism in a way, and it might make them too hesitant to take risks or try new things.
But I have an open mind. James Wood is coming out with a new novel, so I'm hoping it's better than Book of God.
It'll be interesting. He has such a particular point of view, and he's given so many examples of what he thinks works and doesn't work that I'm sure it's easy for his books to be measured against that standard, and which probably isn't fair. You know, he's choosing the best examples from someone like Flaubert to highlight, and then it's pretty hard to make that the standard for a, you know, a 300-page book or however long it is.
Yeah.
Okay, so who was the next one on your list?
So, sticking with office jobs, I just, you know, was laughing at how many insurance jobs there were.
Well, Kafka.
Yeah, Kafka, Wallace Stevens, and, you know, I think there's something about a mundane job that either makes you ready to write because you're just desperate to do something interesting.
Right.
Or makes you angry enough that you're driven.
You're trying to get out.
There's probably many, many examples, but Kafka is one. I mean, he wrote at night and he just hated his job. In fact, his working title, I think I mentioned this on a previous podcast, but his working title for all of his works was The Functionary.
I had a professor, a political science professor in college, and he was saying that he had no aspirations to become a professor at all. And what had happened was he got this job where it was in some kind of lumber yard, and he was just feeding wood into a planer, I guess, all day long. And he would just, you know, pick up wood and then push it through this big machine that would shave it down, and just piece after piece. And so he found that the only way that he could get through a day was if the night before he had been reading. And he would read sort of the densest or the most challenging or most thought-provoking works that he could find. So he'd read Karl Marx, and he'd read authors that he knew he could spend 8 hours wrestling with in his mind so that he could just stay awake and stay sane. And then, you know, after a couple of years of this, he realized he was becoming very good at parsing the arguments, and he was very, very broad. And then he went back to graduate school and got a PhD in political philosophy. For a lot of writers, I think that's how they treat their time as writing, is it's the boost they need to get through the day. It probably gives them something to think about. I would imagine Kafka was thinking through his stories during the day, and then he at night he would sit down and write them out.
I feel like an office job is a very risky job for a writer, unless you're a certain type of writer. I mean, it takes a certain level of concentration. Like Jeffrey Eugenides wrote Virgin Suicides. I think the story is he was working for the Penn Foundation. And he, instead of doing his work, he wrote, I'm pretty sure it's him, but he wrote the Virgin Suicides. And one day, I guess he left it up on the screen and his supervisor saw it and fired him. And you know, it has a happy ending. He's now a member of the Penn Foundation.
All right.
So, but I think it really does take a particular type of person to say, okay, this job is boring, but I'm going to write.
Yeah. Yeah.
I think it's more likely that someone is an avid outdoorsman and then decides they're going to write in their spare time. I don't know. Maybe I err against office jobs as a possible venue, you know, possible channel for writing fiction.
That it's too deadening.
I think it's really hard.
Yeah. So, did you take a number three, or you're taking insurance as?
I guess Kafka.
Okay.
Insurance jobs.
Okay. So I will use this as a chance to transition to my number three, since you talked about outdoor interesting jobs, and I'm going to take Jack London for his job as an oyster pirate.
What?
Yeah. This was, I think, the number one in my category of bizarre jobs. There's some great examples of, you know, Salinger was an entertainment director on a Swedish cruise liner, and Octavia Butler, the science fiction writer, was a potato chip inspector, which is a great job. And Douglas Adams cleaned chicken sheds and was a bodyguard for a family of Middle Eastern oil tycoons. And Jack London was an oyster pirate. So he was young. He was still a teenager, and he was working in a pickle factory for 10 cents an hour. And he decided to become an oyster pirate to make more money, which was a kind of a Robin Hood type of profession. It was illegal, but basically the railroad had leased out tracts of land that it owned along the coast to oyster farmers. So oysters had become a protected monopoly, and that harmed the working class fishermen who had been harvesting the oyster beds before the railroad had come in and taken up the rights to these waters off the coast. And it used to be that the oysters were considered a public resource, but then the railroad got this monopoly on it. So London was only 15, but he bought a ship, which was called the Razzle Dazzle, and he became known as the Prince of the Oyster Pirates. And he would go out at night in the dark, and he would maneuver the ship silently through the harbor. There were armed guards who were patrolling the wharf. And he would maneuver the ship through these oyster farms, and he would jump out, wade through the mud, get to the farms, fill sacks with oysters, and then haul them back on his ship. And then he'd sold them to restaurant owners who didn't really care where they got them from. But then during the day, he was reading a lot at the Oakland Public Library, and his real love was stories and storytelling and everything. So eventually he gave up pirating in favor of writing more. But when he needed work again, he went and worked for the California Fish Patrol and caught oyster pirates. So he turned on his own you know, former pirates, I guess. But he was really, I think he was just a thrill seeker. You know, I think he was someone who couldn't be contained. He had a lot of energy and a lot of excitement and eagerness for life. And I think that really shows in his writing. He's best known for all of his adventure stories. And he did write about being an oyster pirate in a couple of essays, but also in some shorter works. I don't think he ever wrote a novel about it, but I've seen short stories of his, which talks about his experience catching oyster pirates.
Wow.
So it's a great it's a great example of somebody with a youthful job. I found that a lot of writers, they tended to have more exciting jobs when they're younger, which I think is probably just true of humans in general.
That reminds me of how Sebastian Junger, for a while after he graduated from Wesleyan, was a tree cutter.
Hmm.
And people were like, oh, that sounds really fun. He was like, no, it's dangerous. People died all the time. They climbed up these enormous trees, and they had to cut off the branches that were pretty heavy that were liable to fall.
Wow.
Yeah. So he said, you were up. You couldn't be had fear of heights. You were up so high, and nobody wore helmets.
Mm.
But he said, when you came down, it was kind of like when you take off, I mean, probably akin to, you know, taking off your like roller skates. I mean, you felt this levity, you know?
Yeah. Now, was your most dangerous job work a bike messenger in Manhattan?
I think it was probably, objectively, it was probably my most dangerous job, but I think
I thought you got hit three times in one summer.
I got hit by a bus twice, but each time the bus was going pretty slowly.
Yeah, yeah.
So, I mean, it was pulling into a bus stop, and I decided
you were trying to swerve around it.
Yeah, and so, but I think the scariest job I had was I worked in my parents' electronics store, kind of a kind of a tough neighborhood in Jersey City.
Oh, yeah.
And I think it was probably the illusion. It was just the child's perspective. I thought it was more dangerous than it was.
Yeah. But did you have security glass or anything? Or
no.
Security cameras, I suppose.
Yeah, but they...
What would that do, though, if someone came in with a gun?
Yeah. In fact, I think I remember somebody saying to me, I could just shoot you. And I was thinking like, oh. I think the kid said, I could just shoot you and I'd go to jail, but you'd still be dead.
Yeah.
And I was like, yeah, that's true.
That's true.
Absolutely true.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I think that was one of the first lessons I learned, which is you could be right, but you could be dead.
Right. That's justice.
Yeah. It was better not to be right and live.
You'll say, well, I'll bring that up with my parents.
But that, you know, it's funny not to bring too much personal stuff, but I think that job taught me to appreciate free time.
Because you had free time there?
No, because I was stuck there.
Oh.
Yeah.
Oh, the freedom of being of not being on someone else's schedule.
Yeah, because I was probably like 10, and I get there at like 11 and work until 8. Mm. It was probably a violation of child labor laws today. 9-hour day for a 10-year-old.
You know, the funny thing about jobs like retail jobs, I've had this experience. Sometimes it's answering phones and sometimes it's something in customer service. But on the one hand, you know, you hate to be bothered. But on the other hand, there's something very disruptive about having a block of time to yourself and then being interrupted.
Yeah.
You know, if somebody can walk in, like if you're in a steady state of busyness, it's almost better than if you have, you know, no customers for 15 minutes and then suddenly somebody is there at the window. You know, that's psychologically, that's almost harder than if you have a steady stream of activities.
I mean, that I don't know if John Ashbery what job he held when he was younger, but I did read that he often likes to sit in public and eavesdrop and copy down verbatim what people say.
Mm.
And he doesn't use it, and he doesn't transcribe it directly into his poetry, but it does give him some ideas, and it made me think of the poet. Maybe this is a thing with poets. The poet Tomas Tranströmer, the Swedish poet, he worked as a psychologist at a correctional facility for years.
Oh, wow. Well, Amy Bloom was a psychotherapist, and I always kind of wonder how she got away with that. I mean, I guess you just disguise your patients enough, but that could be considered a real breach if the patients feel like they're recognizing themselves in the fiction.
Well, you know, David Foster Wallace in Infinite Jest, the character Gately at the Alcoholics Anonymous, the true Gately, you know, David Foster Wallace fans tracked down the true Gately.
Mm.
And Gately said something. He was interviewed and he said, well, I'm glad David Foster Wallace used me because I don't think there's anything interesting I have to say. And I don't think David Foster Wallace was really that interesting either. he basically was making this argument like, you know, reality is really super boring.
So if you
could make a novel out of this, you know, all power to you. And the interviewer came away thinking like, wow, I just thought Gately was a bit of a genius in the book, but here was the real Gately. Yeah. But he was, apparently some of his conversations were almost identically transcribed in the novel.
Right. Oh, so, interesting. Yeah. So I found a category of people who were very successful professionals. I really liked that. I liked when, you know, William Carlos Williams was a doctor and Zane Grey, the Western writer, was a dentist. But I really like that. Primo Levi, I mentioned already, was a chemist. And There seemed to be, T.S. Eliot was very successful working at a bank.
Oh, yeah. And
there's something very nice about writers who aren't just pulling the William Faulkner and they can't wait to get out of there, but they're actually doing really well at what they're doing, and they find that they have a knack for something, or they're able to rise to the top of some meaningful profession. So I think it's your turn. Do you have any more people on your list? We kind of got away from our draft here a little bit, but that's okay.
I went with janitors.
Oh, okay.
Because I have two janitors. I've got Jonathan Franzen, who was a janitor, I believe, at MIT when he was writing The 27th City or Strong Motion, one of his early books. Uh-huh. And then Stephen King, who was a high school janitor.
Oh. Yeah. You know, that's one of my friend's father's dream jobs. He did that. He retired and he became a high school janitor.
Or wow.
Maybe it was an elementary school janitor. But he talked about it all of his life. You know, the way some people talk about wanting to be a greeter at Walmart or at Disney World or something when they sort of semi-retire. And that was his idea. I think he loved the idea of being in the building alone at night. And just when everything is peaceful and quiet and just getting it ready for the next day, but doing it all by yourself in that kind of night, those nighttime hours.
Yeah. It seems like it's pretty easy, but still a form of labor, physical labor. So there's that aspect.
Right, right. It gives you, it doesn't mentally challenge you. You can, but it's not so physically taxing that it's overwhelming. Stephen King, I mean, the thing about, so now whenever I go into a school at night when I have to hunt down a janitor to retrieve something my kid forgot or something, I have this feeling of, oh yeah, my friend's dad, this was his dream. And I think, well, you know, is this something that I would want to do? And I usually think, oh yeah, it is kind of nice and peaceful. I can see how it's nice to have a little routine. But the biggest thing that gets me is whenever I run across the janitor, I'm worried I'm just going to scare the hell out of him. And I think if I were in that building alone, I'd be constantly worried that someone was going to come around the corner, or my imagination would run wild, which I guess would be good for Stephen King. I'm sure he imagined plenty of strange creatures that could turn up while he was there at the school.
I think it did work for him that way, because he said he was inspired to write Carrie.
Mm.
From the time he spent, you know, being around high schools.
Right.
So.
Wow. Okay, well, let me give another idea, which is Murakami. This is
great.
Something you don't see a lot, which is he owned a jazz bar coffee shop. And it's pretty unusual. I didn't find a lot of authors who were independent business people.
Yeah.
And you'd think it would really appeal to writers, because it can be very creative. You can be your own boss. You can set your own schedule. And you can have that kind of freedom of mind that salaried people don't often have. But on the other hand, I think it can be very stressful and it can be all-consuming, which is maybe why a lot of writers don't follow that path. But Murakami had a pretty successful shop.
It seems like today, I mean, a lot of the picks we chose were probably more than 50 years ago. It seems mm-hmm. like today a lot of young writers are taking whatever job they can get that provides them with health insurance.
Yeah. Yeah,
just so
in America.
So they can get that first novel going. I wanted to make a recommendation for people out there who, if they haven't read it, I highly recommend Laurie Moore's 3-page story, How to Become a Writer. I don't know if you remember this, but it's, I forget which collection, but it's freely available on the web. But she worked as a legal assistant for several years and at a law firm, a big law firm, and she toyed with the idea of going to law school and then decided not to do it anyway. But it begins this way: how to become a writer. First, try to be something, anything else. A movie star, astronaut, a movie star, missionary, a movie star, kindergarten teacher, president of the world. Fail miserably. It is best if you fail at an early age, say 14. Anyway, it goes on and on. It's pretty amusing and also sort of sad.
I wonder if when she was working at the law firm, if that's where she met her first husband, who was a divorce lawyer, and who she used to say later that they got like the fastest divorce, like the fastest, cleanest divorce in history was. I wanted to give my last pick here, which was Harper Lee, the author of To Kill a Mockingbird, and I really wanted to pay tribute to her coworkers. So Harper Lee was a reservation clerk at Eastern Airlines for a long time, and this is just such a great story. So her coworkers, she had worked there for years, and she hadn't written her novels yet. She was just an aspiring writer. And she had been working there for years when she got a note from her coworkers, and it said, you have 1 year off from your job to write whatever you please. Merry Christmas.
Wow.
And during that year, she wrote To Kill a Mockingbird.
Wow.
Yeah, which then won the Pulitzer Prize and, of course, became, you know, a classic book and classic movie. And it was, it's not something you hear very often.
Yeah, I mean, it's pretty amazing.
Oh, this was what I wanted to ask you about. Something, speaking of things you don't hear very often, did you find any examples of, you know, there's this classic paradigm of the writer who hates their job, they get successful, then they're able to quit their job. Mm-hmm. Did you find any examples of that happening in the reverse, where someone was a successful writer, they started doing a job, and then they actually preferred the job, and they quit writing?
No.
I found one.
Yeah.
Maybe we should put that out to the listeners. That could be a challenge. Who is the author? Yeah, a little trivia question, and maybe people will come up with examples that I didn't find. But which author or writer found another profession and gave up writing? Maybe they gave up writing because their creative spark had flamed out or something. But we will leave that for the listeners. Maybe I'll come back on the next episode and give the answer.
We should maybe do an episode or do a follow up to this about taking who people consider to be, like, you know, the 100 most successful writers and just seeing what the jobs they had, if they had any. Like, did George Eliot have a job? I mean, I don't know. I mean, Dickens was an actor and a playwright before he started selling his works.
And he was, Dickens also had an early stint working in a factory, which I think obviously went on to really inform his writing career. And while he was there, he met a guy, you know, the people he met there, he used their names in later works. which is great.
And we didn't talk about Melville, all his sailing experience. And, you know, so there are people who I feel like they kind of threw caution to the wind and they did whatever the hell they wanted.
Yeah.
And then they ended up writing about it.
Are you thinking about William S. Burroughs and his job as an exterminator?
Exactly. And then there are people who just, you know, were incredibly educated and sat in rooms. I mean, I think of Henry James. And just wrote these such microscopically perfect details about people.
Yep.
I mean, I know he was a socialite, and so was Edith Wharton, but I don't know. I just feel like James didn't do much.
Yeah, right.
And maybe I'm wrong. So,
you know who I'm surprised you didn't mention, too, is George Orwell.
Oh, yeah.
Who almost seemed to seek out jobs to write about them.
He was a super. He was like he was basically a superhero.
Yeah.
Fighting off, going to fight wars. Yeah.
Yeah. Going down in the mines.
Yeah, you're right.
And the shooting an elephant, you know, working as a Indian Imperial police officer.
Yeah.
He's somebody who he probably wouldn't have had to work. He could have spent his whole career probably as a critic, but he made himself get out there and work, I think, as a way of experiencing more. And I think it was probably to feed into his view of what a writer should do and also just what a human being should do, I guess.
Yeah.
Philip Larkin had an interesting job, was a university librarian. And Nabokov, I had forgotten that he had become a curator of the Butterfly Museum at Harvard.
Wow.
So he found a way to get out of the house, too. Okay, so does that wrap it up? Do you have any others, or does that take us through all we have? We've covered quite a few different authors and their professions.
Yeah, I mean, I was wondering, like, how about people who are incredibly successful at their jobs, like Winston Churchill, and when did people find time to, like, when did Barack Obama write his memoir? When did he find time to write?
Yeah. You know? Or Vaclav Havel, who was the first president of the Czech Republic, and he was still writing this brilliant, brilliant essays even when he was president. I guess writers who have it that entrenched in them, they don't want to give it up.
I mean, like Heller wrote Catch-22. It took him 8 years to write it. He was working in an ad agency during the day and then writing 2 to 3 hours every night. I mean, so Harper Lee taking a year, I think, probably Heller's experience is more common. If you have that day job, I don't think you're writing the novel very quickly.
Right. So. Right. But that might be better.
Yeah.
That might be a better pace.
Yeah. So everyone go out there and play some lotto.
Lottery winner. That's your recommendation for aspiring writers out there. Become a lottery winner. Okay, well, let's wrap things up there, and this is good, and I'm glad you're able to take some time off from your own job and head out on vacation. We're going to try to put a couple of more shows in the storehouse here, so we'll be able to spread them out even when you're gone. But in any case, thanks for joining me again today on the History of Literature.
Thanks, Jack.
Okay, there we go. My thanks to Mike for joining me for that wonderful conversation. We have some more coming up. We have a two-parter on Literature Goes to the Movies. I can't wait. Remember, you can support the show by heading over to patreon.com/literature. As of now, I believe there are 0 supporters. Maybe you will be the first. Let me know how it goes. That's patreon.com/literature. And if you have a quiz answer, shoot me an email, jackwilsonauthor@gmail.com, jackwilsonauthor@gmail.com. I'll mention the lucky winners on the air. We all know writers who quit their day job. Name a successful writer who quit writing in favor of their day job. See? Trivia contests. New ways to support the show, i.e. beg for money. It's going to be a great second 100 episodes. I'm very glad you're here with us. I'm Jack Wilson. Thank you for listening, and we'll see you next time.